Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So we continue at the Sydney Institute in this time of pandemic, our virtual meetings, and on this occasion today, Peter Cosgrove makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He gave our annual lecture some years ago, and he came here again after that. So he's one of Australian best known Australians. So I'll introduce him briefly. Sir Peter Cosgrove, AK, CVO, MC, former Chief of Army, former Chief of the Defence Force, and Australia's 26th Governor General. And we're here on the occasion of the launch of General Sir Peter Cosgrove's memoir, which has just come out, and a fine book with a great cover and some great coloured illustrations and some fine writing. So congratulations. Tell me, why did you write it? You've already written one memoir.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's wonderful to be back at the Sydney Institute and with you, Jared. But I wanted to... I reflected on why did I write, because I thought my public life had finished in 2006. I'd finished with the military. I was going on to boards. I didn't see that there was any particular public aspect to those boards. You're accountable and all that sort of thing, but you're not really out there. So I thought, well, that's the end of that. But then some of the boards I was on, one in particular, Qantas, had some very, very interesting corporate history around that time. And that was, to me, quite unique. And then there was the disaster relief thing after Cyclone Larry in Queensland in 2006. And then the Governor General job. So that, in combination, I thought, well, somebody ought to write about some of these things. And that changed quickly to, well, I'll have a go. I'll write another memoir when I finish being Governor General.
So it's a while since I've read the original one, my story. But tell us about this, because a memoir starts with you born in 1947, growing up in Paddington, going off to the Catholic primary school, St Francis and Paddington, and your sister, I think, went to a primary school in Wallara. So you were were you a working class kid or a middle class kid?
No, definitely working class. My granddad lived at home. He was a clerk in the Sydney office of the Australian Tax Office, but he'd been a World War One and a World War Two digger. And my father was still in the army. You know, he's a warrant officer, but we were working class. Mm-hmm. And we were in a suburb that was salted through with veterans from World War Two, men and women. Mm-hmm. And of course, a new wave of migration. We had, to my intense interest, an Italian family from fresh from the boat from southern Italy next door to us. And they were so exotic. This was during a wonderful period in Australia, after the war, when we were starting to establish a wonderful economy.
So it was well before what Paul Keating called the basket weavers, or what I would call the sandal wearers, moved into inner city Sydney.
We'd moved out by then.
Would they take you back now, do you think?
I don't know. I would be interested to meet them, but I've walked around the streets of Paddington more recently, and it is definitely gentrified now. But the one thing you can't give it is more real estate. So all those people who own those wonderful restored, transformed terrace houses still have to park on the street.
You went and had a look at your own house. You mentioned that, your old house.
I did, yes. That was fascinating because I was tapping around with a television team who were doing a sort of bio type show, and they wanted me to lean against the fence from the outside, of course, you know, being on the footpath, and I'm being filmed. And a lady came out from the house, and she was a Swedish lady, as I recall, and she was quite interested to know why a man was leaning on her front fence being filmed. I was a little embarrassed, but the television crew were, they were very possessed. They said, oh, well, you should watch the show on next Wednesday night.
So we learned a bit about your father,
yep.
Who's a warrant officer after service. And so where did he serve in the Second World War?
Well, he served initially in Darwin, in the Darwin Mobile Force, which was a sort of a quick aggregation of the very small elements of the permanent army at the outbreak of the war, whistled up there to be a garrison force for Darwin. After a while, he joined the AIF, the second AIF, and was posted over to Nauru Island, where he and his colleagues were bombed soon after the Japanese entered the war through Pearl Harbor. In the next week or so, Japanese bombers came over. The gunners were there, artillery battery, to be on the lookout for German raiders who might want to steal the coal supplies or knock out the radio station, that sort of thing. And they were the defence. But instead, what came over was a flight of Japanese bombers and bombed them. And they were soon after that evacuated back to Australia on a Free French or Dutch destroyer. And then he was in the AIF during the wars, you know, getting ready to go to the islands, etc.
Yep. And you mentioned your mother was a Labour voter and your maternal grandfather was a Labour voter.
He's a trade union official. I think he was a member of the Labour Party.
Now, your mother would have done what was then called home duties, I guess.
Absolutely, yep. Okay. Once the kids were upon her, especially with Dad, this is post-war, Dad being in the permanent army still, he was posted to wherever there was a job and would commute home as often as he could. So that meant Mum had the parental duties.
Yeah, so you mentioned your mother's a Labour voter, although she does take you to listen to Bob Menzies down at Bondi, I think,
yeah.
And your grandfather. You don't talk about your father's politics. That's because he's an army man, is it?
Yes, he was silent. I think because he felt it was the easiest pathway forward. I suspect he may have been conservative, but being a soldier, it was traditional that you don't speak on about your politics. Not a bad policy to have.
But that's in your book too, isn't it? You don't speak on about your politics.
Well, yeah, I try not to, because after all, as Governor General, I had to be ready for a change of government at any one of the two general elections we had. So I felt it best to both be and appear impartial.
But even before that, I mean, reading through your book, you've done so many things,
yeah.
But you don't express many opinions at any stage of your career.
Yes. Well, as a servant of the Commonwealth for 40 and a bit years in uniform, I was comfortable in keeping my opinions to myself, but of course I would go and vote on election day. So I would have an opinion there at the ballot box. But remembering too, as a senior officer, I was looking to serve the government of the day. And the government of the day, for the entire time I was very senior, was the Howard government. So it might be said I've got familiarity with that side of politics, but equally I had people I liked and respected and had very convivial relationships with on the other side. So. But in terms of political opinions, I've kept them largely to myself.
Because even in the period of the 60s and into the 70s, when you're much more junior in the Australian Defence Force than you became, looking back, you don't reflect on what your opinions were in those days either. So,
no. Well, they.
But
were...
you did have some.
Oh, yeah. Well, remember, I've offered situational opinions. Let me give you an example. When Malcolm Fraser, in the ultimately unsuccessful re-election campaign in 83, I think,
yes,
I'm saying,
yes.
Came to visit in Townsville, he said he wanted to come and see some of the army, so somebody told me he will visit your unit. And I was conscious of this very large man that I'd seen on the television quite a bit, in person was a craggy giant figure, but looked absolutely exhausted. And I've been rude enough to say that I didn't think he should be carried in a limousine, but in an ambulance.
and he lost. So there we are. So take us back again to your youth, because we've got a similar background to a little extent. I mean, we both went to Catholic schools, Catholic primary schools and Catholic secondary schools.
Yeah.
You're quite interested in the Queen's visit of 1954. I turned up on a couple of occasions, but I didn't have much interest in the Queen. I was interested in her as a celebrity.
Yeah.
But you seem to be quite fixated on the royal family from the time you were, what, 7 years old?
Yes, and I think, again, Jared, that might well come from whatever I experienced then with this family that, well, two of them at least, were not of conservative bent, but they had deep regard for and respect of the Queen, our constitutional monarchy. There was no particular thought, armoured cars and tanks and guns came to take away our sons. None of that stuff, no republicanism running around in there. But they were socialists. But and on my father's side, still serving, there was this automatic obedience to, loyalty to, you've taken your oath to, the sovereign.
So the reference to armoured cars and tanks and guns, as you know, that's a song of the Irish Republican Army.
I do know that. I do know that, yeah.
So tell us, I mean, what's the kind of Irish connection in your family? Your Cosgrove appears to be an Irish name.
It does. Comes from County Tyrone. I know this because in preparation for a state visit to Ireland, some people in Ireland, probably our diplomats, checked out the origin of our family. And the Cosgroves come from County Tyrone, which, as many will know, is just on the fringe of the Republic and Ulster, Northern Ireland. In fact, it's mostly in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And when I was having lunch with the Irish president, he's a very Irish, and across the luncheon table he said, "Oh, where are you from?" And I said, Mr. President, my mob's from County Tyrone. He said, "Oh, you're a Protestant." And I said, no. I said, "We are Catholics." "Oh." And I said, "But you won't like this part. My ancestors were in the British Army." "Oh," he went off again. And I said, "But they didn't ever serve in Ireland. My ancestor joined the British Army and served in Burma, where he was shot in the arm, became disabled in that arm, and then migrated directly to Australia to set up a new life." So, I can tell you all that. So, yeah, we're Irish in background.
That should have been good enough for a Fianna Fáil guy, I suppose. So tell me, well, as you know, Winston Churchill didn't think much of the men and women of Tyrone or Fermanagh.
He
thought the Catholics there were pretty low rank.
Yeah.
And I think he thought Australians were pretty low rank.
Yeah, too. But I mean, we came, that was when typifying people by class, by religion, by ethnicity, was commonplace. And I think one of the great developments in social behaviour is to downplay that. You can't get rid of it entirely, but it seems to me then it was quite natural. I mean, we had some we thought they were quite amusing epithets towards migrants when we were younger in this country. And we meant them in good humour, but perhaps, heedlessly offensive. So we have, as a society, evolved away from perhaps even the great Churchillian references.
So you're growing up, you go from St. Francis in Paddington to Waverley College,
yes.
Christian Brothers.
Yes.
Now, around this time, at the end of the Second World War, by then you're moving into the mid and late 50s and into the early 60s, but sectarianism, anti-Catholic sectarianism is fading, but it's still there.
Yeah.
Did you experience much?
Not at all. Waverley was a power in its own right. And when I left Waverley and entered the army, I found that within my peer group, there were a mixture of faiths and those who were of no faith. Nobody cared, nobody knew. Perhaps when you did church parade, you might find, here come all the tykes over here, and there go all the other denominations into the other chapel, and there were a small number who didn't do anything. So you might sort of know, but not particularly, and it didn't matter, because you're in the same PT class, falling off the apparatus at the same way as the Protestants. So that sort of thing, you were just all of one company.
You had a bit of a problem with the apparatus, didn't you?
Yeah, I proved not to be a vaulter. Well, a very poor vaulter. I only knew one vault called the Thieves' Leap. And some who know me better said, oh, how appropriate. The Thieves' Leap is a basic vault. There were much more complicated vaults which we were supposed to master.
You caused a bit of damage to the sort of vaulting horse, I guess.
Well, imagine a fairly primitive vaulting horse that you build up with sections and it dismantles. Well, I dismantled it by dint of vaulting into it rather than over it. And every time I would destroy the vaulting horse, it would take time to re-establish it, and the PT instructor got very annoyed with me, and in the end understood that no matter what vault he gave me to do, I would do the Thieves' Leap. And that way his apparatus would stay assembled.
So at Duntroon, you describe yourself as not a very distinguished student or cadet or whatever the term there is, but you graduate. Many of your colleagues don't. I think about, what, two-thirds graduate
yes.
in the early year?
110 started, 66 walked out the door at the end.
Okay, what happened to that lot?
Well, they variously might have failed exams to the point where they weren't able to continue at Duntroon. There might have been an injury which was simply going to preclude their service. Or, and there's a number of these, people who said, this is not for me. And, of course, we're talking over 4 years, so the attrition rate was pretty big. But we were the biggest class ever to go through Duntroon. We were in there on the sort of early cusp of Vietnam with the army at war. And youngsters like me were flooding in with the thought of baby boomers in the shadow of the war generation going and serving their country.
So before we get to Vietnam, obviously the ones who stayed, and you were one of them,
yep.
What you could accept clearly, although you weren't always, I guess, the most obedient cadet, but obviously from a very young age you could accept the discipline that army life requires.
Accept or go. Just sort of, do your job, get into the consistent behaviour that the army wants out of its leaders, or go and do something else altogether.
But in private conversation, I mean, you're a bit irreverent. You're not that serious a type, but in your military and other career, you are. So what, you park your irreverence outside your official duties, did you?
It comes like a rabbit out of a hat sometimes, even when I'm in the job. I found to be of good humour enormously important when I was the chief of the Defence Force many years later, to talk about the most serious subjects, but find time with colleagues, very professional colleagues, to enjoy lightheartedness and to break the mood of very serious contemplation. Then you can return to the serious stuff. So I parked it. I never managed it.
So before we go on, just go back a bit. So your father's Cosgrove, and that's an Irish background. And in a sense, your irreverence is a little bit Irish to me. So what about your mother's background? What's her maiden name?
Henry's, H-E-N-R-Y-S.
So where's her family
from? Well, I think half and half, but England. The Henry's name comes out of England. That was, I think, one half of her family line. But there's a bit of Irish there too, because she had an Irish temper, I can tell you.
Well, a lot of the Irish, you know, went to England. So
yeah.
She had an Irish temper, didn't she?
Yeah.
But you managed?
She managed, yes. She was a very great advocate. I mean, in Paddington, she was a lovely lady, loved by all, but feisty. And, you know, I remember once when a lady from up the road was putting used liquor bottles in our dirt tin, which was out for the garbo, and Mum caught her at it. And a discussion ensued.
She didn't do it again, right?
I don't believe that lady ever came back.
So we've been through discipline. Now, you graduate from Duntroon. Your father's very proud of you being a warrant officer.
Yeah.
Your mother's probably a bit concerned about your future.
Yes, because she been a daughter of a soldier, the wife of a soldier, now mother of one, and she understood that with Vietnam we had a serious shooting war, and that if I ended up there, well, we'd all be on tenterhooks.
But you wanted to go there. You were in a hurry to get there.
Oh, yes.
So tell us, before you got there, you go to what?
Malaya.
Yeah. So what happens there?
Oh, I'm a platoon commander in an Australian infantry battalion on garrison duty in Malaya. But that garrison duty had us training out in the jungle quite a bit. So I was actually learning still a great deal about what you do in jungle warfare while I was in Malaya, where nobody was shooting at us. So, and I was in the presence of very experienced soldiers, because a lot of them in the battalion were just back from Vietnam. They'd been through Tet, they'd been through the Battle of Coral, and here they are now, back in Australia, straight up to Malaya, and they are my NCOs. I couldn't have wished for a more experienced practicum before getting into the real stuff in Vietnam.
So for those watching today who are not familiar with the history of Vietnam, Coral was a very big battle, the Tet Offensive was important. Just briefly summarise what they were about.
In 1968, in around May, there is in the Buddhist liturgy, there's the Tet Festival, and it's a national moment in Buddhist countries like Vietnam. So the opposition, North Vietnamese Army, COS VIN, the political entity in South Vietnam that was for unification, they decided to have a major offensive, and many thousands of North Vietnamese Army and VC assaulted various apparently secure parts of the South Vietnam, including Saigon. The battalion that I had now joined had been on one of those routes of marching to the battle in Saigon, and were assaulted in their turn by thousands of VC and North Vietnamese Army. Major battle. So there were a lot of those people in 1RAR in Malaya, having come home and then come up to Malaya, and they were the people who trained me.
And then Coral?
Oh.
It was a big offensive?
Yes, yep. Coral was, that happened during Tet, and that was a fire support base where 1RAR was located, and that's where these mass attacks on the wire took place. So a lot of my colleagues were veterans of that, and I would sit listening to them about their experiences. And this is even before I went to Vietnam. So I went into Vietnam with that advantage over other officers who'd gone up, like me, inexperienced. I had vicarious experience from these people.
So you knew all about Coral, you knew about the Tet Offensive, you knew all about what Vietnam was like. Because in Australia at the time, some opponents of the commitment said it was all about fighting the Viet Cong. But as you make clear in your book and in your earlier book, you're also fighting the North Vietnamese Army, which is a very well trained and equipped army.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, the communist powers, China and Russia in particular, were sponsoring North Vietnam. So they had access to technology. They made life tough in the air for the United States Air Force. So that's fine and fair, because the US Air Force was dropping bombs on them. But I want to paint the picture that it was jungle warfare against a guerrilla enemy in places. In other places in South Vietnam, it was against formed groups of enemy in something resembling World War II style battles.
So you're in Malaya, you know all about Vietnam from talking to the NCOs who have spent time there, but you still want to get in, and you move quickly to try to get in, right?
Well, yeah, I'm eager. Remember the out of Dickensian writing, Barkus is willing. Barkus was willing to marry the widow. This Barkus wanted to go to Vietnam. So I let my career planners know I was eager as anything to be up there. And lo and behold, in the middle of 1969, I'd only been out of the college for about 7 months, I get an order posting me to Vietnam as a reinforcement officer. I was jumping out of my skin, both apprehensive and excited. And my company commander in 1RAR in Malaya said, "Now you're going in 3 weeks. You are going to go through the most intensive preparatory package I can design for you. He was a veteran of the tour of duty in Vietnam. He's a mighty man. He's now passed, Tony Abbott.
The English writer George Orwell once wrote that he met many a young child who wanted to play with a toy soldier, but never one who wanted to play with a toy pacifist. Now, obviously, you had a similar drive yourself. I mean, you wanted to be a real soldier in a real battle.
Yes. I must say, you're less experienced. Until you've been in a battle, you don't know what it really is. It's not, I suppose in some ways it's a bit like a Western where, an old Western where you used to shoot somebody and they'd fold over, fall on the ground, no sign of blood, and they'd just be lying there looking angelic. That's not battle. You find out about that. And the thing is, once the scales have been removed from your eyes, what do you think then, after that, when you have that realisation? And I can quite understand those many who said, well, I'll do my duty, but I don't really want to do any of this in the future. So, fine. Then there are those who said, well, I got through that. I know I can do it. I'll stay on and have a longer career. I was one of the latter.
So, tell us about... tell us something you weren't prepared to tell your mother. You won a military cross. You talk about a bit in your earlier book. You don't say much about it here. So what do you want to say about that?
Well, I told my mother nothing because I thought she had enough worry knowing I was there.
But you never even told her what you did when you came back, did you?
I would soften it off because she doesn't want to know that at the end of the battle you were standing there and you looked around and there were the remains of your opponents there. That's rather macabre stuff, and I wouldn't tell that to anybody because it, by the military it would be understood, by people outside the military it would be gratuitous. They don't really want to know that detail, but they assume that...
But it's in your military citation.
Yes, yeah.
But there's not much of your citation in your book.
No, because the events of that are part of the experience of being there. I was there for, let's say, 365 days, and we're in battle on a handful of days. That's the nature of jungle warfare. But we were looking for a fight on just about every other day, looking for a fight. Out there patrolling, looking for our adversary. And if we didn't find them by moving and searching, then at night we would conduct an ambush in the expectation or the possibility they would walk along. So that was our duty, and we did it assiduously and pretty successfully.
Very successfully. So under your command as an officer on active duty in Vietnam, you were what was your technical term when you were?
I was a platoon commander.
Platoon commander, yeah.
So that equals about 30 men.
Yeah, so of the 30 men, someone had been regular, someone had been national service.
Yes, marvellous.
Any difference between them?
No. I loved him. My signaller was, he's now passed through an illness, but he was a wonderful man, and I got to know him quite well because he's there behind you every step you take with the radio. And he was an economics student, I think with honours, out of New South Wales Uni. And he had deferred his call-up until he graduated. That was conventional, and then he'd gone through his training, and here he was as my radio operator. And what a fellow he was. When I had battle happening and I've got senior officers on the radio wanting to know, tell us what's happening, tell us what, he would come up with the most elegant prose about why it was very difficult to get me right at that instant because he's actually fighting this person over here. So he was a wonderful fellow, and he was emblematic of the National servicemen. They were fantastic.
So there was no conflict between the two?
No. The regulars were enlivened by having these fellows who came in with that typical hostilities only type cynicism of the Australian. Respect must be won, not granted. So it's that sort of stuff. And the mingling between the regular soldiers and the Nashos was automatic and profound.
So you your tour of duty ends, but you want to go back in again.
I do.
So by then, when you're ending, you're back in Malaya. Are you back
No,
in Australia?
I go back to Australia.
That's right, yeah, okay. So you want to go back again.
Yes, with serpentine sort of encouragements. A more senior officer, when he heard that I wanted to extend, had counseled me, look, don't do that, because if you go to one of the other battalions, you'll still be a lieutenant. But instead of being a platoon commander, you're likely to be made the company's second in command, which means you won't be out there sneaking through the jungle. You'll be doing a logistic job. She said, you don't want to do that. I said, well, I don't want to do that. So he said, you should come home. And then immediately apply to go back with the Australian Army training team, which was mentoring Vietnamese soldiers on operations. Lots of battles and things there. So I think that sounds all right. Well, he spoke with forked tongue, because when I got back from Vietnam and made my request to my posting people, they said, oh no, you've got no chance, because we know that Vietnam will close down and therefore we're sending people who've not been, so all those jobs will be filled up and you can... And the bloke told me years and years later that he knew I'd been put in for a medal, and he thought, well, if he goes to another battalion and he goes out there, there's a chance that he'll get his head shot off, so we'll get him home.
I haven't checked this, but I remember from reading some years ago, there was a story that some of your colleagues, maybe truthfully or untruthfully, said that when you went to Vietnam, you wanted to get a medal.
No. That's a throwaway line. What I wanted to do was to keep my people safe, and I wanted to win. Because winning is not dying. And to me, I didn't want a series of nil-all draws. You know, soccer comes to Vietnam. I wanted to ensure that in any battle, we were the aggressors. We were much more likely to overcome and keep our own lives. Now, what that meant was that platoon commanders don't sit back. You do not sit back and say, you should do this and you should do that. You're up there saying, come with me. So I think for a battle experienced platoon, their concern was that here we go again. Yeah, because they've got a boss who's pretty aggro. I understand this thing of gong hunting, but that was never in my mind. And I overheard that once in a conversation, and my signaller, the great Gary Mayer, told him off, in no uncertain terms, to say, no, he just wants to win.
But in one of these actions, you sort of, that led to your MC, you're pretty well on your own, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, but that wasn't planned.
but it happened.
Yeah, my platoon sergeant took a group of soldiers from our perimeter that we'd set up. We'd fought our way into a bunker system the previous afternoon, and we'd evicted the previous tenants with prejudice. And now we were there, and the rest of the company closed up. So now we've got about 100 soldiers in a big wide circle. My sergeant had to take some people down to get water. And instead of taking one man in two or something sensible like that, he actually took a whole block of people from the middle of my part of the perimeter down to do the water party. And I found this after they'd gone. Oh no. So I told the soldier who was left behind, you're it here, right? I won't be far away. I went up and I'm speaking to the company commander. Shots rang out from the hole in my perimeter. I took off like a scalded cat and found myself down in amongst a bunch of Viet Cong who'd come in. A soldier who snuck away from the water party saw them and opened fire on them, but he was way over there, that soldier, and I'm in amongst these guys, so it was a bit like the gunfight at the OK Corral.
So when a soccer score had finished 3-0,
it was certainly, I'm glad there was zero on one side.
So you come back, you didn't join, I'm not sure whether Ted Sarong was still running the Army Training School then. I think he may have just stepped down.
Yes, I know the name,
yeah,
but I never
he had been
the
involved
yeah.
initially, but I think yeah. by then he was still in Vietnam. So you don't go into that and you come back here and
Yeah, I'm told I'm home for a while.
It's all pretty dull. Nothing much happening. No one much to fight.
Yeah, but I mean, interesting things happened. I went and did a wonderful instructional job where I learned how to be a teacher. And that put me on my hind legs in front of lots of soldiers in a sort of a classroom or lecture theatre environment, different from being a platoon commander in combat. You're now using your personality to impart learning. So anyway, that was fun. And then I became ADC to the Governor General.
We'll come back to that in a minute. But earlier on in your book, I think you say as a young man you were shy.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You're still shy?
No.
So what happens?
Well, I think you get forced to step forward. I probably eradicated my shyness at Duntroon, I have to say, because my Duntroon colleagues would say I was boisterous, flamboyant. Certainly nobody near me would be absent my opinion.
So you go and work at Government House in Canberra with Sir Paul Hasluck, the Governor General.
Yes.
So what are you doing there, bowing and scraping? And
Bowing and scraping. You're one of the three ADCs at any given time.
So ADC stands for?
Aide-de-camp.
Aide-de-camp,
yeah.
Right.
So he has three, or the Governor General has three, Navy, Army and Air Force. They do 1 year each. Their changeover time is staggered so that you've always got a more experienced person to mentor the new arrivals. And I came in, therefore, as the junior guy, took over in November 71 and rotated out November the 72.
And how did you find Paul Hasluck?
I found him to be a wonderfully intellectual man, but I also think Sir Paul was shy. Because while he could do all of his public duties with apparent ease, it struck me that he was a reserved man. I heard him give numerous speeches, and he would write them all. In those days, there wasn't anything like a speechwriter.
Yeah.
He'd sit there and away he'd go. Mind you, I think Governors General there were more housebound. We didn't travel nearly as much in those days. However, so these speeches he would give would be masterpieces, and I'd sit in the audience because he'd be there, and they were so thoughtful. But he was shy. He was not naturally gregarious. So when he'd be interacting with a room full of people, you could see that he was sort of holding back. He wasn't exuberant or naturally ebullient. But boy, did he have gravitas. He certainly did. And because he'd been a politician, I think there wasn't a politician that walked into the house, didn't tippy-toe in, because Paul would know from his own time as a senior politician what was going through their minds.
So just before, we were talking about bow and scraping before, and we're coming soon to when you're Governor General, but
yeah.
I grew up and I still remember some of the places in middle class eastern suburbs of Melbourne, and there was not our house, but there was a gate and there was a tradesman's entry. I think Barry Humphrey's mother had a tradesman's entry. Now, at Government House, you have a public entry and a private entry, so you're sort of moving up. There's no tradesman's entry, but you seem to be pretty fussed about who goes in and out the private door.
No, well, I mean, that's just the tradition, and I was aware of it when I was at ADC. I mean, that's where the Prime Minister arrived.
Yeah.
We didn't have a royal visit while I was there, but, I mean, the rules are the rules, you see. So the rule would be that the people who use the private entrance are the Governor General and his immediate family. And the Prime Minister, and if the Prime Minister's a man, then the Prime Minister's wife, and vice versa, you know, for Julia Gillard, if she'd have brought her partner, he would have come in the private entrance. And the Queen. Even when President Suharto arrived in 1972, state entrance for you, sir.
But someone goes out the wrong door in recent times. Who was it?
Oh, the protocol bunnies, you know, sort of had a heart attack. And I was happy enough for the tradition to maintain and for it all to be organised. And, you know, I think maybe the political leaders understand there is this difference, and that's just part of the mystique. But personally, I was most unworried by the thought that somebody went in the wrong door.
I think
door.
In your book someone goes in the wrong door.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember who is it.
Oh, a minister arriving for a swearing in.
Oh, you don't name them.
No, no, of course not.
No, but at certain times you don't name people.
Exactly. No.
Is that because you're too courteous?
If any opprobrium might attach to somebody, I'd prefer not to name them. If there's high praise, well, I'll name them all day and all night.
Now, it seems to me you're sort of a, you're not quite a Bradbury, but you're always thinking you're going to be going out of the Army or the Australian Defence Force. But
yes.
Then along comes another promotion.
Yeah.
Well, so how does that happen? I mean, you're sort of getting ready to pack your bags and someone rings up and says, can you do another gig?
Oh, it's only really when you get into the later half of your career and the pyramid gets more narrower. Yeah. And a lot of them were my peers from Duntrine, my own class, and the classes just above and just below. Some of their outstanding figures were hugely capable people, and I'd always opted or preferred jobs where I was in command and had people for whom I was responsible. So I had, leading up to, well, by the time I got to be CDF, I think I'd had 13 separate earlier commands of, and that's a lot. Some of my colleagues had very important staff jobs sorted through there in Canberra, close to the centre of power, under the scrutiny of the very senior leadership. And therefore, you know, their stars might be seen to be ascendant, but I'm off somewhere else doing these command jobs. And then I fell on my feet. I was commanding at Duntrine, which I thought would be perhaps my last job. And out of the blue, I was asked to, well, sent to command the 1st Division as a Major General. And that allowed me to be, well, that had me in the position where I went to Timor. And that became a success. And the rest is history after that. I am now a well-known and successful soldier, and I get promoted.
Well, you're talking about how you don't name people with whom you've had. You don't seem to have had all that many disputes in your life, but you've obviously had some. So in you're talking about interference in Timor, and
yeah,
you criticise, obviously, people in the either Army or the Australian Defence Force more generally who say that the logistics aren't good enough and we just scrape through, and you sort of say what?
Well, you see, I thought to say that was to downplay unfairly the huge resilience and resourcefulness of our logistic planners and commanders, who kept looking with dismay at what would need to be done, and crucially found a way to do it. Now, the people who said, oh, we didn't have enough of this or that, seemed to think that we should have so much redundancy for an army of our size that when we do something like that, it all just flows easily. We are a defence force, not an expeditionary force. I have to point out too that by the time we got through Timor, which was at long arm's reach, but still close to Australia, we were set up for the challenge of supporting our forces in the Middle East. Now, admittedly there we were plugged into a big pipeline of logistics out of the United States, but the Australian stuff was operating over thousands of miles on our aircraft, and stuff we paid for. So, you know, I want people to understand that let's not downplay the genius of our logisticians back in 1999-2000.
You're a very Australian character. You're sort of a very practical person.
I want to be.
Which is very Australian in a way, because you've got to make do with what we've got. We're a small nation.
And yeah.
You seem to embody that.
Yeah, well, I'm a very proud Australian too. I mean, the other thing that might be said is that the brooding presence of the United States just across the horizon was a major factor in the relatively peaceful time we had of it when we got to East Timor. And I would just say that with my knowledge of it, that was a vestigial brooding presence. It was, the brooding was at a very long range brooding.
We'll take a couple more issues and we'll finish up with your time as Governor General. So
sure.
You're involved then in Iraq, and you make some important points, how you thought that the errors came after the essentially the United States authorities decided to demolish the Ba'ath Party. So in a sense, the senior Iraqi police figures, army figures are gone. And and in a sense, that's a very serious political error. So, but reflect briefly on that and why you went there, because as someone who's got to look at intelligence, the intelligence you saw was that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
Possibly did. And the possibly combined with the expressed willingness to use any and all weaponry available by global terrorists, that phenomenon had impressed itself upon us. So you get an outlaw regime like Iraq, which had used WMD against the Iranians and also against its own people, the Kurdish people. The intelligence which suggested that it was still there and that it was therefore not under control or destroyed, which is what the UN wanted. All of that meant, well, now it's a very educated guess as to what is the risk. You're estimating risk. And the risk is that it could fall into the wrong hands and then be applied in the subway in London, the MCG, or Yankee Stadium in the United States. Somebody might let off a chemical weapon and now you're in big trouble. And then we'd be hanging from the lampposts, the people who said, oh, well, perhaps, it might be there, but chances are not. So I was pointing out in this part of the book that intelligence will always be imperfect. We had perfect intelligence about Pearl Harbor a little bit after 8 o'clock on that Sunday morning, the 7th of December.
Yes. And the political errors with the Ba'ath Party, they were essentially made by United States civilian figures rather than United States military figures, weren't they?
I don't know for sure, but I know it was US policy. Look, we'd been to school on this. We had to look at what happened after World War II when we had in Nazi Germany, the Nazi Party was outlawed, but I think perhaps the occupying powers there understood that so many of the national functionaries were de rigueur members of the Nazi Party, that, renounce your Nazism and get back to work. That was a problem. The other thing was disbanding the Iraqi army. Trained soldiers, hundreds of thousands of them, many of them conscripts, but the total disbanding of them sent home people disgruntled, feeling deflated, defeated, lacking the pride in their uniform, whatever pride they had, and now very biddable by people who wanted to resist further.
I remember the Foreign Minister, Alexander Downer, talking at the Sydney Institute around shortly before the invasion and saying that the aim of the Allies was decapitation, as you know, just remove the top leadership.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that didn't happen.
The top leadership, fine.
I mean,
I'm saying that permeating down through all the arms of administration in the country were so many people who were, if you want to have a job, mate, you're in the Ba'ath Party.
So you can do this other various work with emergency work and of course your time on the Qantas board, which is an interesting chapter in itself because the airlines closed down for a week and that's all pretty tough. But you seem to give pretty strong support as a board member to management.
Yes, well, we were bleeding money, and there was the sort of crisis moment when we had the board meeting where the unions were going to force their cause, and the investors, the owners, being institutional investors and also retail, the mums and dads, had voted ahead of time, electronic voting. And when the REM report and the re-election of directors were the agenda items.
REM report. Okay.
That came back at, I'm going to guess, 97%, where it was historically 98 or something. So the impact of the campaign by the unions to reflect through the vote that we were on the nose didn't occur. And in the aftermath, the unions were giving, the reps were doing, giving doorstops outside, and they signalled that the industrial campaign against Qantas would continue, and that we will continue to do Qantas slowly. So the next day, we're doing the sums and the losses to Qantas, it was thought we cannot keep going. So management proposed, the board agreed that we would have the one tool left to a company under the industrial laws, which was to propose a lockout for, I think you had to give 48 hours or something, notice so that the workforce could make arrangements to be locked out, schooling, all that sort of, all the things that people do. So, and then because we're an airline and flying people around, and we had people, we were talking about the safety of our customers, so we grounded the airline with immediate effect.
Tough decision, but it worked in the end.
Well, we were sent to arbitration, which is what we had been anxious to have. We wanted to go to arbitration. The unions weren't willing because they were, you know, pressing this case of through industrial action, and the government wasn't interested.
In your book, you don't say which government it was.
Oh, it was easy. It was the Gillard government.
But in your book, you don't say that.
No.
Well, you say it was the government in 2011. That's...
Yeah. Well, who else in government? I know it was Julia Gillard because she
was leading
the government in Chobham.
I'm just making the point in your book, you're not very political. You don't even say it.
No, no, but I mean, that's a matter of history. Yeah. Okay,
So you get two calls from, I mean, you're in retirement some years now, or from the army, you're in retirement some years, and you get two calls in a period. You get from Tony Abbott, one asking you to become Governor General, one asking you if you're happy to become a knight. But let's forget about the latter one, because that became controversial later, not then.
Yeah, sure.
It became controversial with Prince Philip, not with you and Quentin Bryce.
Yeah, yeah.
But Governor General, now, reading your book, I tend to think you're a bit tough on John Kerr. You had to deal with Malcolm Turnbull, you had to deal with, or Tony Abbott, Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison, but Sir John Kerr in 45 years ago, in 1975, had to deal with Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser, who were not such reasonable people. So you had Fraser, who wanted to block supply, and Whitlam, who wanted to govern without supply. Neither was backing down. Supply was running out. Kerr dismisses Whitlam, as you know, and you say, well, he should have consulted more, but the prevailing view, including some quite prominent people, said that if Kerr had told Whitlam what he was going to do, Whitlam would have sacked Kerr, and then the palace would have become involved, and Kerr's principal position always was to keep the palace out of it. So you're only talking to Tony Abbott and these sort of people, but Whitlam in 1975 wasn't quite like the older Whitlam we all got to know in the 1980s and 1990s. So.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And of course, I am using 2020 hindsight, but I wanted to think of the full range of responsibilities, and we call them rights, but they are a convention that you to be consulted, to advise, and to warn, or to encourage, sorry, not to advise, to be consulted, to encourage, and to warn. These three describe, in particular, the relationship with the Prime Minister of the day. So, for example, to be consulted, you do not want to hear from the Leader of the Opposition. To encourage, you will not be encouraging other than your Prime Minister. And to warn, well, that is the relationship between you and the Prime Minister. So, they come from Badgett, who wrote in the Victorian era, and that's become convention within the Westminster system. So, why do I say warn? Well, did Sir John add to or subtract from the reputation of the Governor Generalship? That's an easy question. With the controversy, people became suspicious of a person intruding into what is a democratic process. So I don't agree with that. I don't agree that he intruded illegitimately in, but I would have perhaps thought it was reasonable to do one more step. Now, let's think of the situation in that period. The Whitlam government had been through several elections and was in full uproar, tumult, in the last half of 75. You had what was essentially a device come upon by the Fraser opposition to block supply. The Prime Minister was not of a mind to go to the polls to try to procure a different Senate. So that was an impasse, and Sir John Kerr knew that. I think if Sir John Kerr had said, okay, I am proposing something which will be radical. We know that because he did it, and it was a radical outcome. I will say to the Prime Minister, I've watched this, we've spoken, you're confident it will be resolved, but I'm not seeing it being resolved. I see that government is not functioning. I will call you in a couple of days if this has not been resolved, and I will terminate your commission or determine your commission. If he said that, it is quite possible that Mr. Whitlam would have done a few things. One was take it seriously, go back, find a way forward. Call an election, or to do something within his party to unblock.
But you're missing one. He said, John Menadue said, that he would have sacked the Governor General.
Yes, he might have said that. He might have said that. But that's my other thing. He might have then gone to the Queen and said, I've got a problem here, I've got a Governor General who wants to sack me. And that would have involved the Queen, and although I have utmost respect for the Queen, you're the Governor-General of Australia. You are not on guard in a sentry box at Buckingham Palace. I think the Queen would have been terribly distressed, could I put it, that she'd be asked to intervene to sack a Governor-General. I know that. But on the other hand, in Australia, what would have happened to a government which had said to the Queen, that Governor General is saying that, you know, we're in a mess here, and he's going to sack me and give the commission to the other fella, so I want you to sack him. That would have been very obvious, and I think it would have been the total destruction of the government of the day.
But it would have damaged the palace too, because Kerr's position was always to keep the palace out of it. In all sorts, that's why he didn't get deeply involved with it.
Yeah.
But at any rate...
But I'm thinking not so much of Sir John Kerr, nor even of the palace. I'm thinking about the prosecution or application of the office of Governor-General.
Now, if everyone who's been Governor-General since then, it seems to me you're the only one who was ever possibly going to be in a position that of a kind similar to what John Kerr was in, because if you look at Malcolm Turnbull's memoirs, he says in his memoirs that he was going to go down to Government House and call an election in order to resolve his political problem. Now, it turned out that he was removed by the Liberal Party before he got there, but he's either dreaming or he's serious, and he could have rocked up at Yarralumla and asked for an early election while he didn't have support of a majority of his own party. Yep. So, and it seemed to me of all the Prime Ministers since Whitlam, in temperament, the one most like Whitlam is actually Turnbull.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it was a moot point because he did not come to Yarralumla and ask for an election. So in dealing with hypotheticals, it's important not to further hypothesise about whether you'd say yes or not. There had been a proximate election in 2016. So yes, we'd already done that, and it was a double dissolution. I've heard those, and I know that it's in Malcolm Turnbull's memoir, but it was hypothetical. I also recall something interesting. There was a governor or a governor general going back in time, who saw something controversial to come through the Executive Council and decided he would call the whole Federal Executive Council, every last one of them, to a meeting, and he canvassed them around the table one by one. Do you say yay or nay on the issue? So that would have been, that's historical. And I only mention that to say one of my eminent predecessors at either federal or state level has decided to do that because that person became worried that this was not something the entire ministry felt.
I must say, that would have been a lot of fun.
No, it was, again, hypothetical.
Taking on Malcolm Turnbull and all the others would have been a lot of fun. Anyway, look, in a way, I'm glad you didn't have that fun, but you had a lot of fun in your career.
Oh, yes.
And it's all down here, and you shouldn't have joined if, how's the joke go?
If you couldn't take a joke.
If you couldn't take a joke, and obviously you can take a joke.
I think it's in your book. That whole ironic saying is to remind everybody that being in the army is arduous and sometimes not a lot of fun, but if you keep your sense of humour, you'll still be a human being.
And you've shown that today. So many thanks and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much indeed, Jerry.
Okay.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.